We made this.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey!
Hello, and welcome to Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast here on the We Made This podcast network. And obviously some kind of wormhole has opened because I am hosting this time around. I am Carl Bryan, your host for this episode and indeed the next episode. And I am joined by Mark Adams. Hello, Mark.
Hello. We thought we'd do a gimmick because there were eight episodes and we didn't know what to do for the final block because we normally have like three guest hosts. So we came up with this. Carl, you've got to do a good job.
I will do my best. And also we have Kurt North. Hello, Kurt.
You mean this podcast is vrooming out of control? We're absolutely zero expertise at the helm.
It's about the same as normal.
He's not wrong.
I'm doing all right. I'm now going to be completing the Series 7 recordings, each of which, of all eight episodes, I've been ill. Yeah. So I'm doing a really good job of being ill this series.
You've been an absolute trooper throughout Series 7, it has to be said.
And considering that consistency isn't our strong point, well, you've at least been consistent with this.
Yeah, and I've obviously the compression I normally apply onto recordings has actually applied to my chest, so it's not exactly the most exciting thing. I mean, the COVID one back in episode 1 and 2 when we did it in the heat of the hottest day ever, which was the hottest day ever in the UK, was hard enough, and then realizing I had COVID after that, I thought I'm gonna have to take a test here, and I wasn't positive. But yeah, it's been a challenge, but I'm through it all. Well, I've got maybe another 3 hours of recording worth to do, but I think I'll get through it. Yeah. I think I'll be all right.
Brilliant. Right then. Well, and what an episode to be ill on, because we are talking today about Epideem, episode 7 of series 7, which went out on the 28th of February, 1997. All of the sevens.
Nice.
So we get started with the title sequence, and just thinking about it from watching it back for this, this is probably the most action-packed title sequence we've had, I think, over all of them. There's explosions and fire, and it does seem to give across that more action-y one than, say, in the previous ones we've had a lot of reaction shots and things like that, but in this one there does seem to be more stunt work, almost, for lack of a better term. What do you think there?
I think it was probably deliberate, because we've talked about quite extensively the way that they gently changed the kind of focus of what they wanted the show to be. So that's probably true.
Yeah. I mean, I noticed watching this back, I watched this a couple of times in preparation for today. There's actually a lot going on in this episode. They really do pack in a lot into 27 minutes.
Yeah, they're doing it. It's interesting that the even it's a kind of an unusual two-parter as well, because it wasn't originally planned to be that way. Mm. So I find it fascinating that they actually do pack as much as they can into this, and then obviously you get the following episode, which does go off on a tangent. So it's quite interesting that they've done it that way, where, you know, if you think about potentially a rewrite, they might have made this more of a two-parter and actually, you know, instill both episodes. But this was, I think, maybe part of what we've been saying over the year, over this series as well, is seems to be that the controls have gone out the window, and it's all like, let's do loads of footage and try and edit it down to 27 minutes. And every single episode has either overran or they've had to cut loads out. So it's just intriguing and something new for the series. Mm.
Yeah, I think there are points in this episode. I noticed that there are a couple of cuts, and we'll come to them when we do, but they seem to cut early, and it almost jars a little bit. And I don't know if you've noticed the same things in the episode, but I'll mention them. But there is quite a bit, looking at the DVDs, there is quite a bit deleted from this, including an ending, which is removed from this episode as well. So let's get into it there. So crew are going along in Starbug as per, and they are heading towards an astral glacier which is an altropically modified glacier surrounded by an envelope of luminous gases. Or, in cat speak, it's a big ball of ice.
I mean, to be honest, that's Mark speak as well.
Again, the cat Mark blur is definitely, you've slowly gone into more cat-like tendencies over the years, Mark. It has to be said, you're very lithe and you've got great balance as well.
Lithe maybe, as long as it's not during lockdown. Great balance, no.
So Kanchansky is very excited to see one of these glaciers, as she's studied them before, but she's never seen one up close. And they are indeed Fabaru. Now, did you cringe at the use of the word Fabaru? Because I did. This was kind of part of the Kanchansky in this season that I wasn't a fan of, the kind of jolly hockey sticks, you know. Oh, it's marvellous, you know. And it's
right.
But I kind of had to remind myself, I don't know if this is just me doing a headcanon myself, that this isn't Claire Grogan Kanchansky. This is Chloe Anna Kanchansky, and she does come from a different dimension, so there are going to be some differences.
I liked it. I'm sorry. I liked it.
I really liked
the kind of clash of class, much more than I prefer the clash of the sexes. I think the clash of class works better, because she's not kind of mocked or treated badly for being upper class. She's just shown as naive but not cunty, and I like that. Whereas some of the jokes of the clash of the sexes are just a bit crude, whereas I quite like words like Fabaru. It's like, you would never say Fabaru, but if all you'd had was a pony called Trumper, maybe you would say Fabaru, you know.
I think it falls into the same box for me as people who say hollybobs.
Oh, you just no, don't say hollybobs.
Yeah, exactly. That just, it's just buttock-clenchingly cringe for me, that word.
I mean, I would agree with Mark that to a point, some of the stuff it's upper class bit kind of grated on me earlier in the series around that when they were doing the opera and the arias and things. I was a bit like, oh, okay, having to deal with that on a monthly basis for the operas that we have at work is interesting. You know, having that kind of class actually at my work. I do prefer that rather than the country that you know that Mark was alluding to there. You know, like sort of instead of wearing the Stetson hats and stuff. That's what he said, wasn't it? Country.
Mm. Yeah. No, I said country. Yeah, I was. There's a very big difference between country and country.
Oh dear. So Lister mocks Kanchansky for being a bit of a nerd, and Lister is proven right that she is able to tell you the average rainfall of Venezuela. However, I did Google it. It is not 3.5 inches. It's 35.5 inches.
Well, that's global warming though, Carl.
Well, it goes from 35.5 inches to 80 inches in a year in the coastal areas.
It's not Kanchansky that's the nerd. It's you.
I do my research. Got to do this for the show.
There's a great line in this scene that made me so happy because it was subtle, but I couldn't help but miss it because I kind of use this language a lot when I'm implying that I'm stupid. I hardly didn't get no formal education myself. Now, I will phrase things like that if I've been dumb, like I didn't do no free, that kind of thing. And yeah, it made me smile because it's something that I do. I'm not sure it's quite quotable, dwarf, but it's kind of inspirational dwarf.
Yeah, it's quite a clever sort of use of it because it kind of just slips in under the radar that the cat, when the cat says that. It's almost a bit sad, really, because Crichton points out that he's been on his own for a really long time, so he did have to teach himself.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know anything to begin with. Yes, Kanchansky rebuts that they don't have any accomplishments apart from who could do the highest ever pee. I can't see the cat doing that myself. I think that's purely a Lister thing. But Crichton says he's a Bachelor of Sanitation that he achieved at Toilet University, studying the lavatorial sciences. If this had been a joke for anybody else, I'd have thought that it was laid on a bit thick. But coming from Crichton, I think it worked really, really well.
Yeah.
I like the deeper aspect of it as well. I like the fact that, you know, she's saying, well, it's just programming. And I thought, that's interesting. That's a sentient question.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's just programming. All you need to do is, like, download the information and you know it. And when Crichton was like, oh, I still have to take the exam.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. I thought that was a nice little moment because there's not very, we don't get very much of that anymore.
No.
But to have that as a thought or, you know, something to actually digest and think about, I thought was good to actually have that in there.
Yeah. Mm. Also, we learn about Joseph Bramah, who painted the flush toilet in 1778, which is true. And one of his original toilets is still around in Queen Victoria's house, which you can still go visit to this day.
Gosh, which is special.
That's right. Oh, yeah. We're all going on a day trip. One of us will get locked in. Right, so the plan is to go to the glacier to siphon off the water for their supplies. Yeah, I like this little fact because they do still have to scavenge. They do still need to siphon off water from glaciers and they do still need to do things so they don't have to drink urine recycle all the time and they can have fresh water. I quite like that. And it's also what keeps them around. They could just get out of there, but they stay to siphon off the water. I think in this series, you do get quite a few fun little details like that just to remind them of this is their day-to-day of what they have to do to keep going.
Mm. I think you're right that it's a nice little reminder that there are mundane days on Red Dwarf because the vast majority of Red Dwarf time, which we don't see because it would be boring, would be mundane. There's a lot of fucking space. Nothing's happening, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So the plan is to go down there. However, Crichton scans the planet and he finds something there. It's a starship. Is this the first time we ever hear of a starship? Because we've had shuttles, we've had this, that, and the other, we've had freight. But hearing a starship does all of a sudden sound very big and prim and proper almost. I always think of a starship as like the Hollow Ship, and that it's going to be something quite upmarket.
Oh, so like almost like a class rather than a style.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't spot it, but maybe it was just in 1997, it was a more fashionable term that had become more widespread and well-known because there was that five-year break, wasn't there?
True. So they get into their winter outfits. If they were the action figures, it'd be the Arctic Adventure crew, including Kat's fabulous outfit from Marooned making a comeback with the big jacket and the hat. And
yes,
Lister's
clever.
Bigger coat and bigger deerstalker. Lister says it's really hard to break into, although he doesn't actually seem to have much trouble getting into the ship.
I wanted to talk about this, actually. The bazookoid at this point has essentially become the sonic screwdriver. It is a gun. It is a chisel. I don't think I mind it, particularly in something like Red Dwarf, where it's rush the plot for the laughs is kind of important. But it's certainly something that you would maybe recognise more because of the culture of the sonic screwdriver since the Doctor Who relaunch in, what was it, 2005?
Yeah.
Well, you know how I think how ineffective or effective it is depending on the plot.
Mm. And the other thing that I want to pick up on, you just mentioned action figures. Why were there never any Red Dwarf action figures? Wands.
I mean, they did figures of RoboCop back in the day, and that was an 18, so I'm sure they must be able to have done. Or somebody must have had that conversation at some point. So they are on the Leviathan, a 23rd century Jupiter Mining Corporation supply ship.
Leviathan!
I think it's quite nice that they do run into another Jupiter Mining Corporation ship, just because you don't hear that much about the JMC. You do later, not to give too much away, you do hear about bits later on in the series. But I think it's quite nice that they actually ran into somebody else who works for the same company as them, just to go, oh, this was a huge company. But it appears that this ship's engines have completely overloaded and they ran out of power. And there's corpses everywhere, which I don't think you'd have got in a previous series. But in this slightly more serious one, you kind of do.
Well, they did have when the Despair Squid they did have quite a few dead bodies that had all taken their own lives.
Mm.
I don't think it was quite as graphic, though. I think you're right.
No. This one was just more like a battlefield, and they were just all strewn everywhere. And
yeah, it's kind of like going onto Everest and seeing all the bodies that hadn't survived and stuff like that. That's apparently there's hundreds of bodies on Everest. But and I suppose it matches with the frozen sort of ship element, doesn't it? They were the kind of like the froze to death rather than the one in, like you're saying, Mark, was more a case of they committed suicide and the obviously the humidity and the warmth and stuff that they've that just decomposed. So this like actual bodies being in the ground, which is in some ways a lot more
gruesome. Yeah.
Scary. Mm. Yeah, and gruesome, yeah.
The fact that Crichton points out that their faces are frozen and twisted in terror as well was a bit of that extra sort of detail on top, just to, I think, to make it a bit more serious of, oh my God, what happened here as well. Crichton surmises everybody must have been running from something in order to be this scared and everybody to be in this much trouble. And Lister suddenly falls to his knees, yelling and screaming. However, it is just a blob of ice water going down the neck, back, and finally, crevice.
I like his line. I like the way he delivers the line. I don't think it fully works.
No.
I don't think it really hits, but the way he actually says it, it's just growled on me back.
Yeah, it's...
which was great.
It's something I think we could probably all identify with as well. Like you say, I don't think it was delivered brilliant. There's a few jokes in this I don't think are delivered particularly well, but the ice water down the back, if you've had it done to you, you will go, oh yeah, no, I remember, yeah, it's that thing you do recognize.
Yeah, and I think it's good to mention that they went back to Farnborough, which is where they did Ticket to Ride. So they're back in that thing, and Chloe had said that it was they were where Concorde jet engines were being tested and things, but all the crew, and I've heard this happen on different sets before, all of the crew were wearing hard hats because it was a really low ceiling and there was a lot of things, pipeworks and, you know, things you can bang your head on. But obviously the actors couldn't, so everyone was protected health and safety-wise, except for the actors.
Yeah. Well, everyone has got big hats on. I think apart from Chloe Annette. Chloe Annette doesn't have one. And obviously Robert Llewellyn's got, what, an inch and a half of rubber.
True. Yeah.
So they come across a huge block of ice, encased in which is a woman. And again, a nice little detail here. Crichton's looking for her JMC ident chip, which I thought was a pretty cool thing. Just a little bit of sci-fi bump, just kind of like, oh yeah, we've all got chips that say who we are in case we get lost or something like that. Probably the equivalent of, like, you know, dog tags.
Well, it's fascinating that didn't exist as a thing when this was made. But a friend of mine's a piercer, and he has a machine where you can implant a chip into the soft fleshy bit underneath your thumb.
Yeah.
And then you can program your card into that chip. You can use your palm to pay for goods and services with your credit card. And so you can get chipped with information on you now, which I'm not sure you could in 1997. So they predicted the future.
No, I don't even think you could do it in, like, cats in 1997, because that was the first time I ever heard of chipping, was you get your cat chipped.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is Pasha chipped, Mark?
She is. Probably got the wrong address on, but at least it's got my phone number.
Yeah. So she ever gets frozen in ice for 3 million years.
I don't want you to freeze my cat. She's the best.
If we do freeze her, we'll freeze you with her.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah. That'll be the spin-off. Mark and Pasha in the future.
Good.
Okay. So, from the ID chip, she is identified as Caroline Carmen, who once was on Red Dwarf as a supply officer. Lister says he remembers her and that she made a pass at him at one point, which Kachansky fails to believe. However, Lister is insistent that he and Karen had a thing.
I love how just gets the lie, perpetuates the lie, and creates more lies. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
It's why I don't lie. It's not because I'm a nice person. It's because I just don't want to get fucking caught.
It does have, if you have ever told a white lie and it's like you get caught out from it, you do feel that, don't you? Like,
it wasn't a white lie. Yeah, well, it was just a lie. It's just lies to impress a girl. There's no white.
No, I'm saying for us in general, if you tell a white lie and it comes back at you, you do feel that. You do feel that kind of, oh, crap, yeah, okay.
It did make me wonder initially if he had run into her and then the lie just went from there. Because obviously Kachansky's there and, you know, there's a woman on board, you're on the cop. But I thought he might have been like, oh, no, I do actually remember who that is. But then he just goes off on one about who, you know, because if you think, well, she's frozen and blatantly dead, you might be able to pull it off. But then, yeah.
But also, gosh, she's sort of showing how intelligent and aware that Kachansky is as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lister is bragging about their bedroom gymnastics, including the fact that her neighbours on the ship had to rename her Carmen Moans. I couldn't work out if this was a pun or what. Is it? Because is it something I'm not thinking of?
Not that I spotted.
No, it really felt laid into like, this means something. And I was like, I can't think of anything. And then he says that if she was alive, she'd tell Kachansky and back him up, which is all well and good until Crichton points out she is still alive. And Lister backpedals immediately.
Ice amnesia. Ice gives you amnesia.
And it is affecting Crichton already.
That's quick.
Yeah, I liked that bit. I thought it was really quite good. They decide to get the ice block back to the bug and grab at it, and I've put here in my notes, in a way that says that they know that they're going to cut away, so they just kind of put their hands on it. It's, yeah, they know they're not going to have to actually lift it, so everybody very gently puts their hands on, like, the top corners of the ice. And he's just like, you can't lift it like that.
Yeah. And the camera, is this the one where the camera goes down and then into the next scene?
This is the next bit. This is one of the cuts that I thought was quite weird. So back on the bug, the ice does not want to melt, even though it's 90 degrees. Now, they don't say whether it's Fahrenheit or Celsius, but that still seems pretty warm for a spaceship. Yeah,
but I think but the way they get around that, they say about the ice being like self-developed by the actual creature. Mm. So it's actually being replicated itself until it's ready to come out of its ice. It's not technically ice.
Mm. Yeah. And one of the things as well in this episode, I think, that I didn't really notice until watching it again is how nice the quarters look. We haven't really had that much of the quarters. We've had bits, but this one and I think Duck Soup are quite quarters heavy. And you're sort of seeing that, you know, Lister's got his own room and he's got a spare bunk and all this kind of stuff. And it's quite a bit of a nice shout out to the set design to Mel Bibby, I think.
But he's only got a spare bunk because Rimmer's gone.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think of that. It's weird how, obviously, Rimmer's still in the title sequence, but it feels like he's been gone for a while by this point. You know, they've done a very good job of moving straight on to Kachansky, and the dynamic has changed quite smoothly, I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah,
yeah, even with the teething issues with the character itself. So it's cold and unresponsive, and then Crichton Sassy Chip engages and takes a jab at Kachansky, and the reaction he gives, the kind of naughty, ooh, I thought was really quite cute.
Yeah, just before that, though, what I wanted to mention is the when the ice is melting and it keeps going back to Lister and then going back to the Medibay, is the kind of the haunting kind of lullaby music.
Yes.
That it's got that ding, 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 and then it goes to a dong when it goes back to Caroline. I thought that was really nice juxtaposition between the two of them, that it was giving you that kind of like, oh, look at that, Lister's so nicely warm in bed, he's so happy and cozy, and then this real dark, this ominous thing is coming to get him kind of thing. I thought that really worked.
I'm so glad that you pointed out something like that, Kurt, because my notes for this particular section are Crichton's naughty face, love heart.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
What can I do?
So they do the weird cut where Kachansky starts to duck down behind the ice, and it goes into the next scene, which I can't work out if there was a deleted scene there or if it's just a bit of a harsh edit. But as you said, we start to see the ice. It doesn't even melt. It breaks, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Caroline starts to break out. And she's not looking her best, is what I've put down here. I've put down, she looks across like a cross between a zombie and a thundercat.
She does.
Nice.
This is some big hair that we're dealing with here. And I do remember, it's in the DVD special features, the interview with the actress, I think Nikki Leadbarrow, and they said that they pretty much like backcombed her hair to infinity and then covered her in Copydex, which she didn't want to do. Yeah, but it works. I mean, she looks like she's been in ice for 3 million years and is possessed by it. It's a very good makeup job. Something I thought was quite cool is we get the horror film killer point of view shot as she's walking around looking for anybody. And as you said, it's intercut very well with Lister snoozing happily in his bunk until we start to see the covers go up and Lister thinks Kachansky's giving him a bit of a booty call.
What are you doing? Hey, what are you doing?
Yeah,
that is class. I do love this scene.
Caroline removes his long johns.
Do you hear the audience member that goes, whoa?
I didn't actually know.
So I will query the long johns, though. They're too clean.
Yeah, I thought there would be a one piece as well, but they're not, are they? It's just the bottoms he's got on.
Maybe it's still 92 degrees, I don't know.
Yeah. Also, Lister tries to play hard forget for all of 3 seconds. Sort of with what makes you think I'm going to jump straight in bed with you? I mean, you're right, but still.
That's the kind of gag I would crack in the bedroom, because no one would believe me if I played hard to get.
You lush, Mark. We get a bit of ear nibbling before the lovebirds are interrupted by Crichton's totally routine emergency 2 a.m. dusting.
Brilliant.
This series of Crichton, man, is just so funny. He is so funny.
Yeah, I agree.
When he starts doing the whole, like, of trying to avoid him, going left to right and kind of throwing out, just like, and then just completely obliterates the, she's here, so isn't she? I just love it. I just love this entire scene.
It's brilliant.
I think I said this in the previous episodes I was in, how I wasn't a massive fan of the whiny voice. And the more I've watched it now, the more I think it is just the actual volume and pitch of the voice rather than the character itself
that
annoys me. It grates on me like nails on chalkboard. But watching it again, the actual character and him being the almost like long-standing wife and then the new sexy young things come along, if you get what I mean. And we get a lot of that over these next 2 episodes. Also, something I noticed is Craig Charles is in really good shape.
You get some less left nip action in here as well.
We do.
Again, you've had plenty of Craig Charles nipple this
season. Well,
this
it's interesting you say that. I actually listened to the commentary on this, and Craig Charles describes his own nipples as chocolate buttons.
Fair enough. That's sweet. That's really sweet.
You also discover in the comms that Chloe Annette's got a really big crush on Chris O'Donnell because she fancied him when he was Robin, and that Danny John-Jules can't tell the difference between the models and the CGI. Which blows my mind. He can't tell the difference. He's like, I can't tell if he... I'm like, what? What? Have you not got eyes?
In the next episode, there is a shot we're going to come to where the difference between the models and the CG is abundantly clear.
Yeah.
I just find it utterly bizarre.
Yeah, Danny John-Jules is very... I think he's so laid back with these things. It's just like, how did that go over your head?
I know. Everything I see about Danny John-Jules makes me like him more. He gives so little shits about anything and just gets on with his life, and I can respect that.
Yeah. I always love, I don't know if you've ever seen the Robert Llewellyn's Carpool Show that he did on his YouTube channel.
A long time ago.
I saw a couple a long, long time ago, yeah.
The episode he did with Danny John-Jules was just after Danny got arrested for threatening that bin man.
Yeah.
Was he? They said he threatened him with a knife or something, but they go past it where it happened. And Danny John-Jules doesn't care. He'll talk about it. And he comes out with one of my favourite lines. He's like, I've worked with Craig Charles for 20 years. What makes you think I'm going to take a knife to a bin man?
Yes.
He's not a subtle man, is he?
No, he's like, it's a fair point. So, yes, Caroline has been dumped in the shower while Crichton's looking around. However, just as Crichton's about to look in the shower, Kachansky comes in, and I have to say, looking adorable in a long nightshirt and socks, which is the classic 90s lady in bed outfit, I think is the best way to put it. Like, you can imagine Julia Roberts in a rom-com wearing this outfit.
Yeah. Definitely, and yeah. I say that when Crichton's going around, there's bits where it says double bed mode, yeah. And you promised me you wouldn't like him more than me,
yeah.
And all that sort of stuff. And as you say, the way that Crichton actually builds up to, what? Who do you think, Madame Curie?
Yeah.
Chloe Annette in this scene is probably one of my favourite scenes of her. Actually, I think the entirety of this bunk scene.
Yeah, she's. She goes from sleepy and confused to quite angry very, very quickly. When Crichton realises that Kachansky's behind him, he engages in shame mode, which I think is the first time we've ever had shame mode, even though there's probably been plenty of occasions he could have had it, and excuses himself. And then Lister tries to carry on where he thinks he left off.
And the Batman outfit. Why Batman?
Yeah, I've written here, do we think Lister has a superhero fetish? Because this is the second time, I believe, he's mentioned slipping into a superhero costume.
The other one was Spider-Man. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Going off the Smegazine issues, if they'd done a bit of a tie-in and he wants to switch into his Judge Dredd outfit, I think the people at Fleetway would have been very, very happy.
His Judge Dredd outfit? That would be a role play and a half if you were playing Judge Dredd in the bedroom. Fucking hell.
I am the law. Would you do it in the Stallone voice, or would you do your own?
Definitely not the Stallone voice. Ugh.
No.
That film doesn't exist in my world.
Is that not sexy?
Ugh. No.
I tell you what, though, I watched the Carl Urban one recently. Oh, it's still really
wonderful.
Good.
I haven't seen that yet.
It's so good.
It knows what it is. It knows what its budget is. And it's really, really good. Lister tries to pick up where he left off by unbuttoning Kachansky's shirt to not having an idea what he's talking about, until Lister comes up with a line which just made me go, oh no, which is, come on, Chris, rumpy pumpy, let's hit the springs.
It's supposed to be corny, though, isn't it?
I don't know if it's corny or if it's just
bad.
He's just excited. I think he's just excited. He's really, really excited at that point. Yeah. And I like the way he's like, come on, let's hit the springs. Come on. He's really, really kind of like, this is going to happen.
If I was dating a Red Dwarf fan, I would definitely say, come on, I know, Bob, rumpy pumpy, let's hit the springs. I would definitely say it to them, but in no other context is rumpy pumpy, let's hit the springs acceptable.
Maybe that's another special, Mark. We'll send you out into the clubs.
Fuck's sake.
And see how well you do with Rumpy Pumpy, let's hit the springs.
Just put him on the next dimension, jump on stage and ask him to say, welcome guys, Rumpy Pumpy, let's hit the springs.
To be honest with you, I think 2003 Manchester, Rumpy Pumpy, let's hit the springs would have probably been quite successful considering where I used to go. But it's not something I fancy. In 2022, I'm afraid.
Yeah, fair
to
enough.
Not on stage and dimension jumping.
No, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that.
No. Okay. I would have filmed that live for YouTube, but never mind.
So after saying this killer line, which would obviously work at any other point in time, Kachansky floors him with a punch that I can't work out if it's absolutely brilliant or one of the worst punches I've ever seen on television.
It was good enough to go on the theme tune.
True. The rage in her face I thought was pretty good. Just, she's absolutely enraged. And then she questions if that's what Lister counts as seduction and not if he was the last man alive, which kind of made me think that if he'd done it properly, he might have stood a chance.
Well, that's always been the implication, is it? Isn't that he's fucking inept and she might fancy him if he wasn't fucking inept.
Well, it's interesting because we, and this is for next week, but because we do get the first, because it happens in Series 8 a bit, the first line in Krichansky where she's like, you know, not now, I can't remember what she says next week. Well, we'll catch it next week, but she says something where if Lister goes about it a different way, then she'd be quite open to it.
Yeah.
And so that happens in Series 8 quite a bit. You know, it's but this is, we're not quite there yet. It's next week when that's the first time we would get the, I think it's like too dusty or too windy or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what it is. Yeah. It's interesting that she starts to open up in that way.
Yeah. So Lister, she says, not if Lister was the last man alive, which he is.
I am the last man alive. Yeah.
Which just proves Kachansky's point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lister ponders what's happened and he opens the shower, only to be reintroduced to Caroline, who's been waiting patiently this whole time.
And this is where my smeg-up comes in.
Oh, go on. Yes.
I've got a smeg-up here. So, what was the lady? Nikki Ledbrow, do you say she was called?
Yeah.
So when he gets put onto the table and he says about the Clearasil stuff and that there, and then there's a jump cut and it's when he gets thrown onto the floor and he hears slap. He gets thrown onto the floor and he gets hit on the floor like that, and she goes like sort of goes to go on top of him, and then she gets worried because she thinks that he's really hurt himself, and Craig Charles goes, "No, it's all right, love. I was just acting."
Yeah,
brilliant.
And I do like that because it's almost
going, I was all right. Sorry, we're just acting.
In this series, it kind of feels like in this series we're acting a bit more. I mean, I remember that because she does say in the interview that she's quite a, I think she describes herself as a sturdy girl, like who, and I think from seeing that she does look like she could play rugby. She's a big, broad-shouldered woman, so she must have thrown him because he does make a noise when he hits the ground.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so she knocks him down. In the struggle, he rips off her ear and apologizes, which I thought was a very Lister thing. I have an issue with a couple of bits in this, and it's my issue with a few of the episodes in this series, is sometimes they put in a quote-unquote Red Dwarf joke, and it's a bit too long for, like, the flow of the dialogue. Like, the Clearasil commercial joke, you know, fair enough, but I don't think it fits. It's a bit like earlier on, Cat calls Crichton meat tenderizer head, and it just feels so out of place.
Mm. Yeah, I think for that Clearasil joke as well, for me, because it isn't filmed in front of a live audience, it's difficult to hear that bit because everyone's laughing anyway. And it feels to me that this is kind of like a polar opposite to issues I have with the way that it's been filmed before, where you're waiting for the gag, like Crichton doing his double take or moments like that where, you know, they're not quite sure how it's going to land, so they leave a bit of gap, or the Lister and Rimmer kiss, for example, was another case in point. Whereas this one, it feels like maybe the confidence wasn't there, that they needed that extra line, because you never know. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they didn't know what they were doing, but because the laughter's continuing on from just the general from the ear, and it instills another joke on top of it, but the laughter track is already all on top of the Clearasil. And I never quite hear that Clearasil joke quite clearly enough.
Yeah.
That's the nature of Red Dwarf, is when it's not filmed in front of the live audience. Where I've been watching a little bit of Series 8 last night, and there's moments where Chris Barry's waiting for the audience to stop, so that you can tell the difference. And that's the one thing that I feel that's the difference with 7.
Yeah. So in the struggle, he rips off her ear and takes out her teeth with his teeth, which apparently was something he did in rehearsal, and it just stayed, which is quite a nice little touch. And then he receives a French tongue sandwich, and it's that good that Caroline drops dead afterwards.
So this is another one of the classic, what did Craig Charles do to the writers?
Yeah.
Because he snogged another Minga.
Yeah, I think, doesn't he bring it? It's like, oh, you get a kiss this series, but she's dead. So have you ever kissed someone, Mark, and it's been that good they just drop down dead afterwards? Or
no. No. No.
One day.
I tell you what, if he had, then this would be a completely different podcast for the rest of the night.
Yeah, we'd all be here intervening. Mark, you've got to stop kissing people.
What? Right. Okay, fine. Good. Move on.
Are you about to admit to this?
No!
Yeah. Ah, dear. So, yes, Caroline drops dead. Crichton scans her and reveals she's been dead for the whole 3 million years. But if that's the case, what are the life signs and where do they go? And while they ponder this, Lister collapses in a dead faint, which I think was a bit understated in... He kind of Del Boys it. There's a couple of Del Boys in this episode, but he proper just goes down. And it's almost cut a bit short for you to fully appreciate, but he does a pretty good pratfall, yeah. Doesn't he?
It does.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned this. I think I might have mentioned this on this podcast when I was in... I was on holiday and I was watching Chesney Hawks.
As you do.
Because as you do.
Yeah.
When you're on holiday in a nightclub. And there was a gap in the wall. It was like a recess in the wall. And I did a total Del Boy, fell on the floor. I was absolutely hammered at this point. And my mate was right next to me and he went looking for me, turned around, couldn't find me, and then went off into the nightclub to see where I'd gone to. Because he was absolutely hammered as well. And meanwhile, I was stuck on the floor. I couldn't get up.
I did something similar once. I went to a club on what was then the hottest day of the year, but I wasn't drunk. I was tipsy, but I hadn't eaten. And from what I was told, what happened was I was stood at the urinal, I finished, zipped up, and apparently I turned to the guy next to me and went, "Isn't it hot in here?" And on hot, apparently I was like at 11 o'clock, and I just fell straight backwards and crashed onto the floor. And they was like, "Are you drunk? No. Have you taken anything? No. What did you have for breakfast?" And apparently I just went, "Cornflakes?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that's what you've done." So, yeah. Have you ever Del Boyed, Mark?
I haven't. I'm a little bit disappointed. My brother did it once and he was mocked for 20 years for it. But I never have.
I was at a festival that we actually did. We did the sound for it and we played at the end. And the setup was like at 10 o'clock in the morning. It was on the back of a lorry, you know, and they put the stages on the back of back of lorries. So we got the lorry trailer, and we did the full setup, did all the sound for everyone, and we're offered free drink all night, all day, starting from midday, and it didn't finish till like midnight. And when I got onto the stage at the end, I actually at one point was playing, and I looked at my hand, and I remember this. I looked at my hand and just looked at the guitar and went, "I've got no chance of playing what's next." Mm. I just kind of like just went like that, put my hands up in the air and was like, "No chance of playing this whatsoever." And then tried playing, making loads of absolutely horrendous mistakes. Don't know what it would have sounded like. Then at the end, we were having to pack the gear down. Mm. That was not a good idea. And we had backdrops up. I was like standing on top of drum stools and all kinds, absolutely hammered. And then for some reason, I don't know how I did it, but I actually fell off the front of the lorry. Like, and you can imagine how high that was. And it was like, it was all pebble dash car park as well. It was all proper like stony car park. And I flew and there were some chairs at the front kind of set up in like a almost theatre style. And I just wiped out the entire front row of chairs that were still there.
Basically, you deathmatch wrestled yourself.
Basically,
Yeah, so I've Del Boyed and done quite a few falls in my time.
That reminds me of a friend of mine. He doesn't normally drink, and we played a wedding, and for some reason he was just mullered beyond belief, and everyone's like, "My God, what's happened to him?" And we found the video afterwards of us playing, and he's got his bass, and he is literally just holding his bass, and his hand's going up and down, but the other hand is just limply slapping the bass, but he's so happy. He's having the best time ever. He can't remember any of it because they'll say he very rarely drinks and he just no memory of it, but he looks so happy. But he's just smacking his own bass.
Nice.
Right.
Slapping the bass.
Right. So later on, we see Lister is ill and then there's a bit of a debate as towards how men and women see pain, during which the cat reveals he's not adverse to a hot crotch wax.
But rips out half your thatch.
I was going to ask you two both this. Have you ever had anything waxed?
No.
No.
Would it surprise you to discover that I have?
No.
No. Absolutely not. In fact, it would be more of a surprise if you said you had. Hadn't even.
It's not great.
Would it surprise you to know that I haven't?
No.
Yes, it would surprise me.
Or Have I? I might have had my leg done, actually.
Oh, that doesn't count. It needs to be chest or bits for it to really count.
Oh, God, no. I'm far too hairy to get the chest done. It'll be like a sort of lighter version of the 40-year-old virgin, almost. I'm far too hairy for that. Plus, you know, I lose all my bear fans.
It's true. Also, the term tongue-cocky, right? I had not heard that in years. At my school, it was more tonsil tennis as the term, but I hadn't heard tonsil tennis or tongue-cocky for so long.
For me, it was tonsil hockey.
Oh, okay.
So it was a weird amalgamation at our school, yeah. Crichton has established there's something in Lister's blood, a virus he is aware of called Epideme. And then this is one of my favourite little, like, world-building things, is the origin of what Epideme was, because it could work. The idea is sound enough. So originally it was made as a rival for a nicotine patch, and it told your brain that you didn't want to smoke. However, because it was intelligent, it developed and started telling the body it didn't need blood or oxygen. And it kills off its host within 48 hours and then basically drives the corpse around until it can find a new one.
Which is exactly what viruses do in some ways. So
it's just
an exaggerated version, which comes to the point of this was originally Paul Alexander's idea and it was originally a Jasper Carrot sketch.
Mm. Right.
Yeah, so they took it from that.
If you asked a virus what it was doing, it would tell you it was doing its job.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Later on, his argument is very, very strong. Epideme kind of completely outwits Lister, and Lister's got no argument in return. It's scary.
Yeah, it's quite interesting seeing what some of the writers who, because this is the first series where other writers are really brought in, and it is quite interesting seeing the background of some of these writers. Like we said, Paul Alexander wrote for Jasper Carrot, and then went on to write the S Club 7 series and the film after, I think he went straight into it pretty much after this. Kim Fuller, who writes a couple of the episodes, wrote exclusively with Lenny Henry for decades. And James Hendry, who ends up getting brought in as well, he wrote for a lot of comedians back in the day. So it's quite interesting to see that you've got these writers who come in who are essentially monologue writers, almost, to come and do these. And the ones they do come in on do tend to be quite talk heavy, because I think this is Paul Alexander's second script, and the first one is the Stoke Me a Clipper.
Right.
And that one is very dialogue and sort of plot driven as well. And also, whenever Paul Alexander comes in, something quite silly happens, I've noticed.
True.
So it's interesting to see what all these different ones bring. And when Robert Llewellyn writes his episode, it's quite maudlin in a way. It's sort of bittersweet with Abel and the drug addictions and things like that.
Yeah, well, the episode where Robert Llewellyn wrote about 30% of his story.
Mm. Yeah.
So he wrote it so he didn't have to be on screen, and then he put himself in it twice.
And it was going to be three times.
Oh, God. Right.
Yeah, because it was going to be a spare head as well.
So Crichton reasons, because this virus is intelligent, if we use the universal translator, which I don't remember being used before and has just appeared out of nowhere because it's plot needed, Lister might be able to converse with it. On patching in, the virus sounds very much like a game show host, and it is the fantastic Gary Martin, who is man of a million voices. Even to this day, he's still working. Do you know who it was originally supposed to be, though?
Make it so.
Yeah.
What?
So it was, yep.
There was an idea for Patrick Stewart to maybe be the voice.
That would have been amazing.
Well, I think it wasn't that he wasn't available. They actually decided against it, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, it was just considered.
Yeah. And then they were put in touch with Gary Martin through Danny John Jules, who worked with him. And I looked back to see what he worked with him on. He worked with him on The Storymakers, which was a lovely little show for the kids.
Huh.
Yeah, so he did a lot of voices in that. But Gary Martin, obviously, just from hearing him talk, and you hear him in real life talk about this as well, he's the Honey Monster, or he was the Honey Monster,
right, okay.
Which you can kind of tell in the voice he does for Epideme. He's done countless cartoons like Dennis the Menace and things like that. And I think his main income now is video games. He's in the Final Fantasy games. He's in, I think the most recent one, he's in Elden Ring, which has been like one of the biggest games of the past year as we are recording this. So he's still going and he can do absolutely masses of voices. I think he's a really good choice. He's a really good choice for this.
I love the way he delivers line of day there.
Yeah.
And I'd say, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, Leviathan.
Perfect.
So, yeah, it's great. I think it works really well.
Yeah. I wonder how much free rein he was given. I think he was given quite a bit. Obviously, the lines are written as they're meant to be, but I think they've just gone, there's no real way of telling you what to do. So they probably just gave him a rough kind of thing to do and then just let him go.
Yeah, just kind of say, just be larger than life.
Yeah. I'd like to see, I don't think there's any on the DVDs, but I'd like to see if there's any vocal outtakes of him doing other voices.
Yeah, that would be good to see.
I don't know about you two, but part of me, I'd quite like to have seen Patrick Stewart have a go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as we were leading up to this, I was thinking, right, I'm going to mention the Patrick Stewart thing, and then obviously you brought it up. But I was thinking, you know, the YouTube videos where you get like Boris Johnson, where they'd like snippet words together, and, you know, George Bush and whatever. Well, I wonder if you could find like Patrick Stewart. I don't think you could ever find a David in there, but whether or not you could find certain words where you could actually get in to deliver it. That would be interesting to have a mashup of that.
For some reason, I think it'd be easier to find a clip of Patrick Stewart saying Leviathan than it would be to find him of one saying David.
True.
So he cuts a deal with Lister. If he wins, he lives. If not, he dies. And the virus takes all of his knowledge, which he's done with his previous victims. Although with Lister, it's not really much knowledge.
And also just on the screen as well, that Ed Bye had suggested that it would be something more visual than actually just talking to, say, like a voiceover or something like that. So that's why the projected screen became a thing.
Yeah, with the Winamp visualizer.
It was Winamp. Fucking hell, Carl. Love it. Carl, showing our age, having used Winamp.
It's still going as Winamp. It's not too bad.
Can you still get all the weird skins and stuff and like make it look like Super Mario Brothers and shit?
Yep. Oh, I learned how to make them back in the day.
Really?
I had a lot of free time on my hands as a youth. So he takes all the knowledge from his victims, from Lister. He doesn't get to take a lot, although now he does now have the knowledge of how to open a lager bottle with his anus. So how do you think you open a lager bottle with your arse?
Well, I mean, I've seen Sticky Vicky. She does it with her vagina. So I think it's probably possible.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I've seen Sticky Vicky as well.
I have not seen Sticky Vicky, and I'm quite happy I've not seen Sticky Vicky.
There was a lot of stuff in her faff.
I had a problem with my eye, and it wasn't to do with Sticky Vicky. I had to go into the sea. I don't know how I got... I think it was pouring down with rain, and I'd had some P20 on, and it had got into my eye. And for the pub crawl we were on, I'm drinking, and my eye I just had to keep throwing water into my eye. And we were by the beach, and I went, I'm just going to have to go into the sea, lads. So I just ran off into the sea, dived in, opened my eyes for a bit, went back out, and it solved it.
Nice.
A bit of salt water, sorted it out, yeah. Then later on, we saw Sticky Vicky, so which was an eye-opening experience.
And a fanny-opening experience.
When Lister asks how Epidemic could kill him, the virus responds, as Mark pointed out earlier, that Lister killed a chicken to make his curry. I mean, technically, Lister didn't kill the chicken to make his curry, but I see his point. And like you say, Lister has no comeback. Even when he's pointing out he's the last human being alive, Epidemic said, well, it's time for your race to check out. Also, they've had to change it now, haven't they, to he's the last man alive, because Kachansky's there.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, I mean, what do you think about this going into a slightly more deeper, almost philosophical sort of bent with this whole, with the you kill the chicken, so I should be able to kill you? It's not something we could have done in earlier Red Dwarf series, I don't think.
It's sci-fi. It's supposed to question stuff like that, isn't it?
I think the idea of intelligent life and the question about sentience and stuff, because the chicken, is it sentient? Does it think, obviously it says about playing the guitar, don't they? But then, you know, the fact that Epidemic is an intelligent life form, And he's saying it's time for you to come because I'm stronger on the food chain than you are. Yeah. I'm using you as food, really. That's what Epidemic's saying. I mean, where would go from actually Lister anyway, apart from maybe Kachansky or the cat. But then he's got nowhere else to go after that. So what would Epidemic do then? He'd have to freeze himself for another 3 billion years or something.
It is quite interesting that he does make reference a couple of times to he's going to move on to Kachansky, but he doesn't really mention that he's going to try the cat.
Maybe he hasn't got the entomology to do it.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So, after a while, the crew come up with a plan. It's not a great plan, but it is a plan, which is they're going to isolate the virus into Lister's arm and chop it off. Things start to go well. They keep doing injections up his body to move it around, but it all goes a bit awry and goes into the wrong arm. However, this is the only chance they've got. So in what could be classed as a fairly graphic scene for Red Dwarf, they start chopping his arm off in chunks. What did you think when this started happening? Because it's very much a point of, obviously it's a point of no return, he's losing his arm. But what did you think here that you thought was going to happen with him losing his arm?
Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, make it my left arm, my right arm does all my favourite things. If I get an injection, I say exactly that. But because I'm left-handed, it's making my right arm, my left arm does all my favourite things. Mm. I say exactly that whenever I get an injection. And I think I must have known it was from Red Dwarf, but it popped me when I heard him say that. I was like, I do that. So that's my quotable dwarf of the episode. And the other thing about the scene that I really like is the sound effects are so gruesome when they're cutting his arm. It's really grim and really, really funny. Oh, I adored it. Yeah. I adored it. Great, great stuff.
The squelch as well. Yeah.
So funny, yet so macabre. And that's my kind of humour.
Yeah. Yeah. Still not enough. Still not enough. Still not enough.
So, Lister wakes up and he's absolutely horrified that the wrong arm has been cut off, leading to probably one of my favourite lines of the whole episode. What kind of navigation officer can't tell left from right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good joke.
That's a good joke.
Yeah.
Cat being cat walks right in and is so happy to see him, he goes for a handshake.
I think Cat's stupidity and callousness has returned tenfold in this episode. Over series 6 particularly, he was almost painted as competent when it came to stuff like his sense of smell and you know, fashion, etc., etc. But in this episode, he is just so useless and so ridiculous and so accidentally callous and dumb. I'm all about it. It's nice to see the cat back, you know?
Yeah.
So, however, despite the fact they have chopped off Lister's arm, 7% of Epidem survived, and it is now multiplying again back into his system.
Yeah, I have to add in that Crichton's, I know we've talked about Crichton's mould in this season, or this series even, but the way that Lister finds out that it's still there when he goes, it's brilliantly delivered. It's just brilliantly delivered. It's like, oh, you say, at least I'm still alive. Oh, you haven't killed it, have you?
No. They reckon he's got another 58 minutes. So they extended his life by 58 minutes, which Kat's reasons that he could take half a juggling lesson.
See, what I was saying about the callousness, that one's, I think, is accidental. Yep. Whereas perhaps when he attacked Rimmer, it wasn't. But yeah, I love having this cat back just for a brief time.
It made me think as well, is when he said, oh, you could take half a juggling lesson. I thought, well, that's a bit out of nowhere. And then I realised, what do cats do when they're just messing about? They will bounce a ball all around.
Or a ping pong ball.
Or a ping pong ball. So he's actually thinking in cat thought, if you know what I mean.
Mm. Yeah.
So while Lister is away, Kachansky and Crichton are preparing Lister's quarters and they start to argue over how Lister likes things. And again, this felt like old girlfriend, new girlfriend, or even old girlfriend, older girlfriend. And they're arguing over how he likes his pillows. And Kachansky says she knows how to satisfy him in the bedroom, which is the only kind of overtly sexual thing she comes out with about him, really, isn't it? It's because she used to live with him, so she knows how to satisfy him in bed. But Crichton says he does as well.
I mean, I quite like the idea of a spicy tortilla and a horror movie in bed. That sounds pretty good to me.
Kung fu fighting, was it vampire nurses? Or is it just vampires and I've added nurses in there?
I don't know.
I don't know, I'm not sure.
Okay, but while they're getting this all done, Lister has disappeared with a load of plastic and explosives. Incinerex, which... It hits the nail on the head, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit Nitro 9, isn't it? It's just make something that sounds like it's explodium. Yeah. And Nitro 9 being what Ace uses in Doctor Who. Sorry, that was me being a bit gatekeepy. Yeah. But yeah, she creates her own explosive that she then throws at Daleks and stuff.
So Lister's locked himself into the Leviathan.
He's just popping down the shop, though. He's just popping out to the shops.
Yep, he's only going to be gone a minute.
Do you want to
I like the fact that Kachansky tries to do the "if you do this, I'll never talk to you again." So she knows that that's probably the only thing that might work.
Yeah,
but Liss is determined he's going to blow himself up and he's going to blow Epideme up via the comms. They try and talk Lister out of it, but he's determined, and he gives a verbal will to the crew, including all of his laundry for Crichton. Anything Cat wants from his wardrobe, he wants hangers.
Brilliant.
Yep. And the collection of songs he wrote for Kachansky, which is 3, and 2 of those use the rhyme underpantsky.
Great line.
Yeah. And I think this is quite nice in that technically the last human alive that we've been with, this is kind of one of the closest moments we get to this might be the end for Lister. And I think it's kind of touching in his own way. Did you feel like that there's a chance that he, obviously we know there's another episode to go, but do you think, oh, they could kill him and do something later? Or do you think that they were just going to get out of
it? I don't know. I mean, I would have never have thought that they'd have killed off Rimmer, and they kind of didn't in the end, but the intention was that Rimmer was gone. So,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So while Lister's waiting for the explosives to go off, Epideme's chatting away to him, and he points out that the Leviathan were trying to get to something, and they were so close they nearly managed it. This gives Lister thought, and he realises that they were trying to get to a planet, so he stops the countdown and heads back to the ship.
One of my lines in this scene is... your heart says blow, but your brain says no.
Epideme is sublime.
Take that out of context.
Well, quite. But I think if it had been a lesser actor, and I mean this, I know he was, you know, you could mock the fact that he was a honey monster, but the way he just bites down and sinks his teeth right into this very silly part, well, lesser actor, it wouldn't have been quite as cool and funny, but... Yeah, the guy who plays Epideme is bang on. Bang on.
Yeah.
And I also want to mention just before, when they're in the cockpit as well, that that Kachansky has the Dave, my Dave. And she says that. It says even the word hopeless has the word hope in it, which is a very kind of Star Wars kind of thing, isn't it?
Her Dave sounds like a right bell end.
My Dave.
Yeah, I do like that everybody's reaction is to sandbag it completely.
Yes.
And I like the fact it comes from the... It feels like this would be the perfect moment for Crichton, but it actually comes from the cat when he just turns around and goes, I guess you had to be there for that.
Yeah.
So just, yeah, Kachansky's really not pulled it out of the bag. However, Dave heads back to Starbug. While he's lying there, Crichton starts picking Epiderm's brain, and I like the fact that Crichton establishes that Epiderm can't infect him and they have no quarrel.
Yeah, and that's very true, that Epiderm just basically did ignore him.
Which is interesting, which we'll come to in a minute, about the original idea which well, I'll talk about that towards the end.
Yeah. So he picks his brain about how to, well, first he asks him who the fourth Groucho brother was.
Marx
brother, sorry, which is Zeppo.
Because Groucho is one of Marx's brothers, isn't he?
Was it Groucho, Harpo, Zeppo, Bonzo. And...
I don't know, I think...
I guess Bonzo. I've never seen any Marx Brothers stuff ever.
You're not seeing Duck Soup? Is it Duck Soup?
It's Duck Soup, isn't it? Yeah. I've not seen it for a very long time. At my work, we're showing the Harold Lloyd film, the famous one with him hanging off the clock tower.
That's Back to the Future, isn't it? Hanging off a clock tower.
No, that's what spawned. It's what spawned Back to the Future and all those ones.
That's a Jimi Hendrix song, isn't it? Hanging off the clock tower.
It's a great song. Let's see. So yeah, but then Crichton asks him to pick his brain, and he almost asks him in a kind of like, "This has always bothered me," kind of way. Which is, how could he possibly make Starbug go faster? And Epidemic takes a huge breath, which I don't think was in the script. I think it's just Gary Martin looking at the thing he's got to read and explains what he would need to do to make Starbug 300 times faster. And then it's revealed that that is a bit of a ruse so that they can fix it, so that they can get towards the planet that the Leviathan was aiming for before Lister dies.
What I like about this is that they think they've outwitted Epidemic, but... we discover later on that he was always going to give them this information to get what he wanted. I think it's really, really nicely done. And it's more complex kind of plot and intrigue than you'd expect for Red Dwarf. So I think the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, it's really nicely done. Really nicely done.
It gives him a real... because you could almost say that Epidemic's, you know, he's quite fun because he's got the voice. But when you realise he's done what we're about to talk about, you go, what a bastard. Like, he's genuinely bad-natured.
It's dark, isn't it? It would definitely, like, sort of fit well in the books.
Yes, definitely. So when they get to the planet, even though they've got there in time to stop Dave from dying, it's completely scorched. So there's nothing there at all, and Epidemic reveals that they burnt it to kill Epidemic. But Epidemic escaped in the body of a medic who then went to the Leviathan.
He's just so deliciously cunty, isn't he, Epidemic? He takes great glee in his bellendery. It's brilliant.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me, like, obviously years, years later, did either of you watch, this might be a daft question, did either of you watch Battlestar Galactica?
Oh, yes.
Tried it, watched the first episode, went, meh.
It's pretty good. However, I think so. After the third series, it all culminates with them finding Earth.
At the end, it's at the end of the last episode of the season.
Yeah. They find Earth, but spoiler for if you've not watched Battlestar Galactica, there's a lot to get through before you get to this point. But when they do find Earth, it's razed. It's just useless, and they can't settle there. So everything they've been looking forward to for three seasons, and they get there, and it's. It's all dead.
They do that in the tripods as well at the end of series two.
Do they? I've not seen the tripods. So, yes, the planet is completely burnt. All hope is gone. However, Kachansky has one final desperate idea. But first, she needs to nip out of the room for a minute. She runs back in and decides she's going to kill Lister. So she stops his heart, which Crichton is not massively up for. I think the reactions of Danny John-Jules and Robert Llewellyn in this scene are fantastic.
Oh, yeah, just while I remember as well, because when one of my favourite moments of the episode, actually, is when Epidemic is going, doo, 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 and Crichton starts to stand to attention.
Crichton, yes.
He doesn't know quite know what to do.
I kind of like that, yeah, it's built into his programming. If he hears a national anthem, he's got to stand at attention.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, so... yes, Kachansky kills him and then waits a second, but her hand is in front of Lister, and Lister kicks into zombie life and bites her hand. However, as Epidemic celebrates being transferred over to Kachansky, Kachansky cuts off her own arm at the elbow. And this, watching it back, obviously it's a practical effect, and there's fire involved with the thing that's cutting through the prosthetic arm, but Clarionet's sleeve is on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it cuts away sort of with it still on fire. Apparently she had a couple of goes at it. I know there is an outtake of it where she starts to do it, but the arm falls off too early. But yeah, so Kachansky cuts off her own arm, which causes Crichton to do a fantastic shock look.
Yep.
And then the cat failing to comprehend and doing a sideways Del Boy onto the floor.
What I like about this is, once again, it shows how incredibly intelligent and capable Kachansky is, because she's a fucking officer. Mm. And yeah, I love this. This is great sci-fi and it's funny. So this episode is a huge favourite of mine because it manages to get sci-fi right and funny right.
So it's revealed that this arm that she's just cut off isn't her arm. It's a reanimated Caroline Carmen's arm. So she just put some blood and adrenaline in it very quickly, considering of the time frame she did it in. And Epidem is now in this arm.
That's a really good point. That's kind of the opposite of when they run back for the climbing equipment to get Kachansky with in the first episode.
Yes.
That she's in. So, yeah, well, wibbly wobbly timey wimey.
Yeah.
It's a fucking sitcom.
Exactly.
It's not as bad as that one, though. That one, they take an age. This one, you can quite imagine it being, yes, it's a bit short, but it's nowhere near as bad as that one.
Yeah. So everything's all well and good. However, the cat is still lying down, fingers still pointing straight forward. But he'll be fine. And Crichton and Kachansky have a moment as they walk off down the corridor together.
It's a moment of acceptance, isn't it? I what did you say? Mark, I had you marked down as a bit of a madam. But I actually think, you know, it's kind of like accepting her now. And I like that. I like that it's taken the entire series to do this, but he's accepted her. Yeah. And I think that's really good.
Yeah, it's very much like the end of Casablanca, though. This could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship kind of thing. And everything seems great until they realise Lister's still
Mr.
dead
Lister!
On the tape.
Fucking wonderful. Fucking wonderful. How can you not like neurotic Crichton? How can you not love this?
Well, this is the thing is, you almost forget. They're having a moment and they're wandering off and everything's great. And then you go, oh God, yeah, Dave's still dead on the table. They run back in, nearly tripping over Danny John Jones, who does a very good job of still staying in position.
Yeah, he does that amazing job.
They're running over him and they shock Lister back into life. Lister asks where he's been. For the last few minutes, he's been dead. And Kachansky gives him a kiss on the forehead for not being dead.
Germs.
And then Crichton germs. Then sprays him and cleans it because of germs. So while he's accepted it, there's still a little bit
Lister's
there.
Lister's face when he does it, he's like, oh, you cunt. It's fucking great. That just what a way to end the episode. It could have been really fun and cute and romantic with a little kiss. Oh, isn't everything great? And then
germs.
It's just so good. So good. Someone maybe describes a gag, there are things that you think you'll laugh at a lot and things that you go, hurt. Whereas the germs gag, I was laughing through the entire fucking theme tune. I couldn't stop laughing. It's, what a beautiful way to ruin it all and end the episode on. I loved it. Loved it.
Yeah.
Okay, can I jump in and read something for you? So basically, there was a different ending, or there was a different way of getting rid of Epidem originally. Mm-hmm. And apparently, it was... So the finished episode, we saw what we saw. In the original version, the virus was tricked into infecting Rimmer.
Oh. Okay.
Which is an unusual one, because Rimmer's... I know he's hard light, but... How would Epidem do that? But who then would turn off his light bee, allowing Epidem to be blasted into the air with a bazookoid. Another change was a scene where Alyssa tried to find a solution by consulting with some of the history's greatest thinkers in virtual reality, which was actually casted and costumed for, but decided to delete. They decided not to go with it.
Mm. Do you reckon that's where they'd have put Patrick Stewart?
Potentially.
So, yeah, so Rimmer would have been infected. They would have turned the light bee off and then used the bazookoid to blow it out an airlock, effectively, I think. That's the way it was going.
I think I prefer
but
this.
But that must have been really early script before. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there is the deleted ending scene before they decided to go with germs, where the arm gets flushed out into space and it starts floating towards the camera with the finger pointing. And you hear Gary Martin sort of give one final, I'll get you next time speech.
Brilliant.
Oh, right, okay. I don't think I've seen that.
Yeah, it's that's in the deleted scenes, but I think they cut it because, one, it'd be really hard to bring it back, and two, I don't think you want to bring it back. I think it was a great one-off character.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So I think, I kind of think everybody does a really good job in this episode, but I think Gary Martin, just for nailing it straight out the box, it's probably the star of this episode for me. What do you think, Kurt?
I love the way that it's delivered, like David and Leviathan and all that kind of thing. It's just it's a larger than life character. Yeah. It's something they'll use again to a slightly different way in regards to viruses and stuff like that. Actually, within the body, so it's something they'll come back to. But this is by far the best way of doing it. Mm. I thought the episode is a great episode. I've watched it 3 or 4 times, actually. I don't usually do that before an episode. I normally watch it maybe 2 or 3 times, but I actually watch this more. But yeah, I think it's a great addition to the show, and I think it's a strong. Mm. I agree with Mark. It's a strong Series 7 entry.
Yeah. It's brilliant.
Right then. So all that is left is plugs. So, Mark, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I have a reputation for having too many podcasts, but I don't. I've only got one other at the moment, and it's a surprisingly successful and popular podcast about the Child's Play and Chucky franchise. So if you like horror and you're watching the Chucky TV series, have a listen, because it's fun. It's me and my friend Dev talking about killer dolls, and that's at Chucky Vision on Twitter. And we haven't got the other social medias because, as we've established on numerous accounts, that everything else is basically Twitter on hard mode. But yeah, if you like horror, give that a listen. If you're looking for me personally, at Mark Adams HC on Twitter as well.
Kurt, how about yourself?
Find me on Linktree. That's linktr.ee/rmuldrake. It's rmuldrake. You'll find a whole host of things that I'm doing, YouTube channels, the XCast podcast, Star Trek Picard podcasts, and Yellow Jackets and stuff like that. So, yeah, I am the whore of podcasting at the moment.
Massive whore. More of a whore than I ever was. Whore.
Thanks. Thank you. That's what I've been waiting for. I've been waiting all my life to be called a whore. But yeah, find me on Linktree. Easiest way to find me is on there, and anything that I'm doing will be either up on there or, you know, or not, depending on what I'm doing.
Yeah. And if you're looking for me, you can find me at allmylinks.com/Mr. Carl, and it is the unabbreviated MISTER. And thank you very much for listening. If this is your first episode, go back and listen to a lot of the old episodes. We have a multitude of specials going on. And
lots.
That's an understatement, isn't it, really? But yeah, also check out a lot of the other podcasts on the We Made This Podcast Network. And until next time,
make it my right arm. My left arm does all my favourite things. I'm a Leviathan.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found online at wemadethispod.com or on Twitter at wemadethispod.
Do you know your Daleks from your Dreshigs?
Or your Zygons from your Zagreus?
Do you know what the TARDIS stands for?
And do you know which Doctor Who stories featured Kevin Grimlock, the cyborg T-Rex that became the Doctor's companion?
Then this is a Doctor Who podcast for you. I'm Baz Green, and in each fortnight I chat to my son Ben.
Hello.
And the occasional guest as we cover 60 years of Doctor Who on TV, Big Finish, and more.
And I did really enjoy that one. Except that wasn't really actual pirates, it was badger pirates in space, but it was still piratey.
Pirates in space?
Yes. But I am willing to make an exception for pirates this episode.
Donald Sumpter is amazing. I love the fact that he just pops up. He just pops up, probably Rassilon, probably.
Well, they do confirm later on he is.
I think they do,
yeah,
don't they?
He says on Rassilon the Redeemer.
Of course he does, bloody hell.
And he has the gauntlet as well, which gives the hint at that.
Yeah. I'm nodding profusely.
Going proper classic Doctor Who as well, not it as well. Yes. All.
In a week, has done more for the show than for the last 5 years.
I do like how Ross D. Davies is kind of the PR spokesman for the Centurion special. That's quite fun. Yeah.
And he's also saying, "Oh well, Jodie and Chibnall still have an episode left. I'm not going to tread on their feet, but here's 14, just so you know, for the filming purposes." And a week later. Oh, yeah, by the way, these guys are back. Just thought you'd want to know. Find us on the We Made This Network.
And all good podcast providers.
What about the bad ones?
Yes, them too.
Ah, good.
Because somewhere there's danger.
Somewhere there's injustice.
Somewhere else, the tea's getting cold.
You know, we probably should throw that tea away now. It has been sat there since 1989.